Global fisheries. Are the gloom and doom justified? That's the topic of this speech by Dr. Daniel Pauly, given at the University of British Columbia on March 10, 2007. It was part of the top-rated Vancouver Institute series of lectures. The speech is 1 hour long. You can download the lively question and answer period that followed as a separate file from www.ecoshock.org in the Oceans section.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Vancouver Institute. I'm Hector Williams, past president and archaeologist here at UBC, filling in for Joost Bloom, our usual president. It's a pleasure to see so many of you here tonight, and I hope that some of you may even be induced to become members. There is a desk outside, and there are refreshments being served after the talk, and the people there will be happy to take your money. But don't feel pressured. There's also information about the Vancouver Maritime Museum there for those interested in maritime matters. 55 years ago, a film about the environment won the Academy Award. It was Rachel Carson's The Sea Around Us. Her book by the same name had won a National Book Award the year before, and of course she later went on to Silent Spring. Our speaker tonight works for a project called the Sea Around Us Project, among many others. Dan Pauly is one of the most remarkable men at UBC. He has published over 500 papers and given as many talks all around the world. I was just looking at his CV, and he had done at least a dozen in the last 6 or 7 months at points as far afield as Cambridge, England, Lima, Peru, and Punta Cana, Dominican Republic. Nice one, that one. He nevertheless manages to spend a good bit of time at UBC on his research, many, many projects, directing many, many theses. He joined us about 13 years ago, coming to us from the Philippines, where he'd worked for 15 years, eventually as director of a major fisheries research project there. Before that, he had done his graduate work at the University of Kiel in Germany, his master's, his doctorate, his Habilitationsschrift, all in fisheries. He was born, however, in Paris and raised in Switzerland, a multilingual person, and has been here first as a professor, distinguished professor, university professor at the Fisheries Institute, and latterly as director of the Institute. It's interesting when you look at someone's CV to see the kind of work they do, hundreds of papers in different subjects, but books on topics like Darwin's fishes. One never thinks of Charles Darwin as working on fish, but he did a lot of work there. So our speaker's breadth is enormous, and I was just looking at a list of some of his current graduate students and the work they're doing. Historical reconstruction of India's maritime fisheries, evolution and distribution of the global fishing effort, estimating the contributions of small-scale fishing to gross domestic products, the central Mediterranean functions of a large marine ecosystem, or seabird fisheries interaction in a global scale. Most of us here living by the sea have experience greater or less with it. I was raised initially on the shores of Lake Superior, then the shores of Hudson Bay, and have been working in the Mediterranean for 40 years, and have seen the fish that were caught locally go from that to that. And I'm sure many of you have had the same experience. Our speaker tonight, however, will talk about that subject and put it into context. Global fisheries, are the gloom and doom justified? Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Daniel Pauly.
Yes. So good evening. I remember I was about 6 years ago, I gave a presentation for the Vancouver Institute on a similar topic. So maybe some of you were there. But I have not used the old slides. They were laminate, actually. This was not okay. So I didn't. The answer to the question I can give it to you right away is yes and no. But but you would not accept this for an answer. You want to be entertained and this and also informed. And this I will try to do. But don't think it's going to be easy, because I will present some concept that will force you, oblige you to think. Why not? First of all, a well-known Canadian tragedy, Northern Cod, which began about here with Cabot and finding lots of cod in Canada, and here colonies coming to catch cod, and they were catching about 100,000 to 200,000 tons. It was reconstructed all the time with traps and dories. And then, because we have big brains, we invented trawling and increased the catch a lot. And because of this increase, the recruitment of young fish decreased and the fishery collapsed. Or rather, it became possible to chase the European out of the Canadian waters, and the Canadian then built their own fleet, and the fisheries then collapsed, and it goes on. And this story is well known. I talked about it 6 years ago. The question is this a general pattern? Is this what happens in the world in general, or is this an exception? And that's the thinking that will be required. Try to follow with me. Any fishery can be characterized by a time series of catch. In other words, catch in that year, and so on. So a time series. This time series will have maximum, where the catch was maximum. That's a given year. Now, before you reach that catch, which can be called 100%, before you reach 10%, the fishery is developing or underdeveloped. Then it becomes developing, 50% of the catch is reached. Then it's fully exploited, and on the other side, you have overexploited and crashed. The shape of the curve can be different, and we can generate thousands of these curves for countries and species combination. And we can use the fishery statistics of FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, to check how the characteristic of these curves are, and we can add them up, and we get something like that. At first, we obviously had that start in the 50s, we had mainly underdeveloped fisheries, obviously. The fisheries had been smashed during the war and rebuilt, the stocks rebuilt, or we're talking about developing countries that didn't have important fisheries. They became developing and fully exploited. This happened in the 70s, that the transition to gradually increase in overexploitation and crash stocks. In fact, the number of crash stocks increase, and now it makes, 20% or 25%? Doesn't really matter. If we were in the 80s, we could use the trend here to predict the trend here, and we would not be too wrong saying in 1990 this would be that much. Or in the 90s, we could predict what will happen in 2000. We could have. And we would have predicted an increase. Now, there is colleagues of us in Halifax, a colleague called Boris Worm, and a large number of co-authors, including a member of the Sea Around Us project, have published essentially this and have projected them. That had never been done. They obviously use a more fancy curve than I did here, but they produced an extrapolation of this, roughly looked like that, and they, not in their paper, but in the press release that was written along with that paper and which was given to the press, they then predicted that we will have only crash stocks in 2048. Now, 2048, it's like, it's a very precise date. And this has ignited a firestorm of controversy, though it was not in the paper, right? It was a firestorm of controversy, the question is, how can they be so crazy to have a precise date for an event that is extrapolated that way? Well, actually, I assure you, Boris Wurm is actually German. He has studied at the same university I have. He's actually not crazy, and so are the other colleagues. They actually do not believe that it will collapse in 2048. It's just an extrapolation. Similar extrapolations are done when you predict that if you continue to produce greenhouse gases the way you do, in 2100, the temperature will be that much, and there will be so much elevation of the ocean sea level, and so on. It is not assumed that things will remain equal and that the prediction will come true. But certainly, it says, if we continue the way we are, things will happen that we don't like. And that is certainly true. So while this date has been criticized by lots of colleagues, scientists and non-scientists, the trend has not been noted. And that's similar to a quotation I was using once. It says, look at where my finger is pointing. Don't bite it. Don't bite the finger. Look where it's pointing. And this is essentially what happened here. They bit the finger instead of looking where it's pointing. Now, we can generalize another way. We can map fisheries, and the Sea Around Us project is characterized by beautiful map that it can generate. And the first map of the world fisheries is this one, and it was not very exciting, except for, actually you cannot see much, you think, this is the shelf areas, the shallow, down to 200 meters water areas around the continent, and this has around 5 to 10 tons per square kilometer per year of catch, very high productivity. And there are two areas in the world where we obtain much larger productivity by mapping the catch, and it was Peru and Chile, but that we know of 20 tons per square kilometer per year. But we know why this is so, and this is so because the anchovy that benefits from the upwelling of water there, and I will be talking about this anchovy, so keep this in mind. And there was China, and that story, you might have heard it or not, that story was that we could show that the Chinese catch were exaggerated, and we calculated the catch that were actually true. And the result of this is that we could document that the world fisheries catch was actually not increasing as FAO and official documents were stating, but actually decreasing. And if one eliminates the anchoveta, which varies a lot, the Peruvian anchoveta, we can see this decrease very nicely, and this decrease began in the 1980s. In other words, since the 1980s, capture fisheries of the world are declining in spite of the considerable fishing effort that we are doing. And every 2 years, the FAO published the state of the world fisheries and aquaculture. And I looked at it 2 years ago, 2 days ago, and the declining trends has continued, but the FAO doesn't report that. It always reports total fisheries catches with aquaculture together, and that goes up. So the press, which reported on the FAO press release, reported fisheries catches are going up. Actually, fishing catches are going down, but aquaculture plus fisheries are going up. But the FAO published the result with and without China now, because they have to acknowledge the fact that China overreports and these declines are actually, in reality, much bigger if one considers the fact that much of the catch is actually thrown overboard. For lots of people, it is a bitter realization that actually in the 90s, approximately 30 million tons of fish was being thrown overboard. And I can hear credit one of the members of the audience, Dr. Alsop, who in the 80s published an estimate, that is A, that was assessed. This estimate of bycatch that were thrown overboard was evaluated to be a wealth that humans could use instead of discarding it. Well, it increased further, it was not used. Now it is decreasing again, this amount, and FAO says that's because of aquaculture. They are not throwing the fish anymore away. It is landed. But in that case, if it were landed, the catch would not go down, the retained part of the catch, the landings. So there is something profoundly wrong, either in the data, or this is true, and it means that the world catch, which is the part, the landings, plus the discards, is actually declining faster than we even thought. So this is the trend of fisheries catches so far we can see. Now, we know what causes this. This is an enormous fishing effort, and you can see that all coastlines have enormous fishing effort, and one of the theses that was being mentioned was done by one student here, who created a monster database of the fishing effort that is applied to fisheries and mapped it. And we also mapped the fuel needed to catch this fish. This was an independent test of this because this was obtained using different methods. And the fuel consumption to catch this fish is actually enormous. I will go back to that in a minute. If we divide the catch that is obtained worldwide by this effort that is applied to catch it, we find that you need to have more and more effort to catch a certain amount of fish. Or put differently, the catch per effort is declining. And is declining rapidly. This can be illustrated in, for example, the North Atlantic. This person here, Christensen, is sitting here. This is a work that we did together. This is an estimation of the biomass, that is the amount of fish that is in the North Atlantic at per square kilometer. And you can see that on the shelves near the coastline, about down to 200 meters, in 1900, they were about 10 tons and more per square kilometer. And this, in the middle of the ocean, doesn't mean there is no fish, because there is, but it means that there is about 10 times less fish, or less, about 10 times less. And don't ask me how we can know how many fish there were in the sea in 1900. Actually, at that time, there were people sampling the boats, sampling the catch of the fishing vessel, and there probably was less cheating than now, so that we can actually reconstruct how much they were, how much fish there was. And in 2000, this is what is left. Again, this doesn't mean there's no fish. It just means there is 10 times less. Or what you do when you have a problem is obviously to run from it. And what Europe did when it had this problem of having overfished its waters, it's run away from it and fish in West Africa instead. And the Soviet Union, remember? This is this country in North Asia, big. Anyway, the Soviet Union did that also, the Soviet bloc, and Asian countries also, and they began to fish in West Africa. This became staggeringly high for example, in the present. And I could elaborate on this country here. I wanted to do that briefly. When a country like this, for example, Angola, would you have known it is Angola? Anyway, it was Angola. It had a civil war at the time of this. Now, the civil war meant that people had nothing to eat, and it was exporting fish. In some public lectures, I do say that it was like the Irish potato famine, which was exporting, Ireland was exporting wheat as the farmers were starving because there were no potatoes. And there was a man from the industry telling me this is a lie because it's a question of money. They are too poor to buy their own fish. And that's precisely the point. The Irish starved to death because they had no money to buy the fish. And the result of this, and you see Christensen again, what would I be without him? In West Africa, the fish also was reduced by one order of magnitude. Now, these pictures are not painted. They are not drawn with crayon. They are based on computer-intensive work, based on models of ecosystem, which are, in this case, we constructed in collaboration with people in Mauritania, Senegal, Gambia, Sierra Leone, and so on. And you shouldn't think that the African countries benefit from this also. That's the gloom part, or the doom part, I don't know yet. In this case, for example, if you take Guinea-Bissau, which was one of the countries I showed, they get only 7% of the ex-vessel price of the fish that is caught there. The European Union, 93%. And this is only the ex-vessel price. It actually, the value increases as it goes to the wholesale market. The same thing happened in Brunei, and here again, this is work that emerged from a large project that we began in the Philippines when we both actually were there. And this is you can see the abundance of fish that is reduced throughout the region, except in Brunei Darussalam. And Brunei Darussalam is a funny little country that is owned actually by the Sultan. He also has two wives. So in an official building, you have the Sultan and the pictures of his two wives. It is actually funny. And the Sultan owns the country. And he doesn't want people to mess around fishing in between his old wells. You know, they had this film, you saw it with Bruce Willis, when he was oil man in Brunei Darussalam. There it was, before he flew to the moon to save us from some meteor. Anyway, it was there. The Sultan doesn't want anybody to mess around there. So this is a fishing-free zone, and they have actually more fish than elsewhere in the region. That is the result of a large marine protected area. Now, there is no fish. Can we blame the marine mammal? When we have a problem, we go elsewhere because we don't need to solve it then. We can go elsewhere and catch fish. Another thing we can do is blame the marine mammals. And there is one country or more that actually spend lots of energy blaming the marine mammals. And they are eating a lots of fish, actually. Marine mammal together, about 115 species, consume about 400 to 500 million tons of things. That's a lot. That's about 3-4 times what we eat, what we consume from the sea. And if we count all illegal fishing and so on. And that has been mapped very nicely, and the name should be there. It was a student called Christine Kushner. In her thesis, she mapped this the whales, the baleen whales, the seals, the sea lions, and so on, the large sperm whales and dolphins. And their consumption was mapped. Really, it's when you know how many they are, how heavy they are, how much they consume, it's actually quite strong. And then we match the consumption that the marine mammal have with the fishery. Now the fishery are in the same region, in the same cell, if you like, of these pictures, catches similar things or not. And if the things are similar, the overlap will be high. If the things are dissimilar, if they eat things that we don't catch, the overlap will be low. Or if they catch the marine mammal catch the same thing that we eat, but that we catch, but somewhere else the overlap will be low. And so that's the overlap between us and them. And we can see that in certain areas, for example, in Europe and in East Asia, the overlap can be fairly high. And these are the places where we always read in the newspaper there's some fishers that are bashing seals or bashing some whales or killing some mammals. Canada, Newfoundland will be there bashing some seals and making the seal responsible for the collapse of the cod. You know, actually, Canada makes about $40 million on these seals, selling the pelt. And every year it loses $200 million for tourists that are outraged and don't come. $160 million loss. Anyway, you put these things together, and what you see is that the marine mammals consume their food mainly in areas of no overlap, of little overlap. And we have a situation where we could basically kill all marine mammals on Earth, and it would not make much difference to the decline of fisheries. And this is actually what we are dealing with in the International Whaling Commission and so on. Right now there is a tamper, Japan, supported by some countries in Europe, to reopen whaling. It has no basis whatsoever. But the sad thing is that lots of countries, developing countries, are made to vote with Japan by arguments. One of them is bribe and so on. But the other one is the argument, you will have more fish if you help us. But actually, they could zap all the marine mammals in the world and they wouldn't catch more. There is Kisin Kashna. Okay. Now, we go back to basic, and I have to introduce one word of jargon here, and that's the concept of a trophic level. A trophic level is the number of steps you are removed from the base of the food web. Now, in a grass field, the base of the food web is the grass, and then you have cows, and then you have us. That's a tree step. You could have also a caribou eating whatever the caribou eat, and wolves, and that would be the end of the food web because nothing eats a wolf. In the sea, this is very different. The grass is very small, very, very small, macroscopic algae. And the cows or caribous are also very tiny, about 1 or 2 millimeters. And they are water fleas, like water fleas. That's a zooplankton. And the fish, the lions and the wolves, are actually small, the first. This is generally little things. Anchovies, sardines, and so on. And we generally eat things that are atrophic level 4, from 3.5 to 4.5. That's where the action is. That's where the big fish are that we like. The table fish that I was speaking about and showed you on the map. Now, we can compute the mean trophic level of what we catch. That is, each fish typically eats at has a certain diet composition. And looking at, that's what students are good at. They look at fish stomachs and they write up a thesis, and then when you have 100 of those theses, you know what the fish in the world eat. And so you can compute the trophic level that they are typically at. And you can compute then, if you multiply this with the catches, the mean trophic level that fisheries are. And it so happened that the mean trophic level of fisheries is declining steadily. And you can map this, and you get a map like that. This was a map that was done several years ago. And you see that Canada and eastern United States are leading the world in fishing down marine food web. And the phenomenon is everywhere. And because the map is a bit old, is actually, it doesn't represent the full breadth of the phenomenon. We know that generally this applies, and this is the core point of this presentation. We call this fishing downwind food web. This was presented in 95 the first time, and it is used now in lots of textbooks, and there is one Canadian textbook in ecology that has this, and it is a concept that we use to view what happens in the sea. Essentially, you have a situation where when fishing begins, we always concentrate on the big fish. And we as they become rarer by the fishing, we tend to go down in the food web and catch the juvenile of this fish or their food. And these then become rarer, and we have to concentrate on the smaller fish. In the process, because we often usually use trawlers and other habitat modifying gear, we wipe out the bottom of the ocean. Now, these beautiful little things here are not plants. They're animals that eat the plankton that falls at the bottom of the sea and firm up the bottom of the sea. And this is wiped out by trawling. And at the end of this trawling, you have essentially the mud flat. How much of this transformation is happening is actually, we don't imagine how strong this effect is. In 75, I was a young man dashing and in Indonesia, and we were fishing in a place it was a development project. We're developing the trawl fisheries. And what we were catching was not fish. Mainly, we were catching this. And we were transforming a landscape, a seascape, that consisted of these things into a seascape that was consisting of these things, because that's good for shrimp. And that is not good for shrimp. So the sea, it was specifically the Java Sea, was utterly transformed. The big fish disappeared. The bottom the bottom animals disappeared, and it was transformed into the big mud bed. This transformation is now occurring in most parts of the world. And this has lots of implications. One implication is that you get lots of jellyfish, because when you get this resuspension of turbid water, resuspension of sediment, turbid water, the condition of the environment here are very different from here, where you have the environment dominated by large fish, the water is clear, and the bottom is firm. Oops. And now comes two pictures that nobody has ever seen, that were the highlight of, that are the highlights for me of this presentation. They were communicated to me by a young man from Duke University who has discovered that trawlers have crumb trails. You know crumb trails behind the planes? We can see planes in the sky because we see the crumb trail. Well, he discovered that satellite picture have, if you apply the right filters to them, show crumb trail. And if you, I don't know if you can see that. You can see this thing has little side wings. Yeah? Well, that is a shrimp trawlers, because they have actually two nets that they pull behind. And we can separate the comb trail due to the propeller from the comb trail from the due to the net. And I hope, I'm not sure, but I hope we will be able to calculate the amount of sediment that is lifted up globally by fisheries. And there is a very good suggestion that it is bigger than is lifted by natural phenomena. And now comes, it's almost a piece of art. That is incredible. I've never seen it big like this. I'm looking at it with you. This is incredible. It's like a dance. It's like a field. It's the sea. And this is all mud that is stirred up from the bottom. Needless to say, a thing like that is not a natural habitat. Is nothing but a field. The forest is destroyed. And in a field, you get other things than in a forest. And one of the things you get is jellyfish. Now, jellyfish, we eat them. So that's OK. You don't eat them? Well, you will have to, because it's I have eaten them. They're all right. They're OK. We can get used to them. But there are other things that the sea brings up. For example, you can. Pisteria is an animal, very complicated little thing. It has a complicated cycle, about 17 different stages, and their shtick is small, right? They attach themselves to fish in the gills and stuff, and they kill them, and they eat them when they are on the ground or they're rotting away. And Pisteria makes people sick. And in Chesapeake Bay, they have Pisteria. A young lady who discovered the life cycle of Pisteria and discovered the thing blamed the poultry industry for the pollution that caused Pisteria, that she said. But she got death threat, maybe picked to death. But she got death threat. But one reason also why Chesapeake Bay has this is because Chesapeake Bay is not filtered anymore. Filtered anymore by the oysters that before could do the job in 2 or 3 days. The entire water could be filtered in 2 or 3 days. Now, there is no more oysters. They have been fished out. And things like Pisteria proliferate. And another thing that you see the first two pictures of contrail of trawlers that we saw were actually from Texas, which is here. Now, they have lots of those things in the coast of Louisiana and Alabama here. And they have dead zones. Dead zones is the process of fishing down has been concluded. There are no animals. There are no at the bottom that can pick up the excessive growth of plankton and consume it and make it harmless. So that stuff rots on the bottom, eats up all the oxygen, no more oxygen, everything dies. And dead zones are all over the place and increasing in the world. There are dead zones in Europe, there are dead zones in North America, and the first dead zone in this region has come up in Oregon. Yeah, I think you have read, if you have read the newspaper, about 1 year ago, they have come. It's being attributed, obviously, to the climate and to the environment, but actually, the removal of animals that offered a buffering capacity is probably a factor. It is clear that this dead zone is connected with the Mississippi, which brings lots of fertilizer from the Mississippi. But the bloom that the fertilizers induce, they would be eaten up, in part at least, by the bottom animals. But they're gone because of these trawlers. So we're changing topics. We're back in Canada. We don't know about that. Why? Because it doesn't affect us. Because if we go to the shop, we get the fish. Where do we get it? We get it from places that are still providing us with fish. So we don't really notice. But if you go to Granville Island and you look really what is there, it's salmon, oysters, and the rest is all imported. There is fish from New Zealand, fish, shrimp from Thailand, everywhere, but actually there is no fish from the Georgia Strait and barely any fish from some halibut from the coast of British Columbia. That's about it. The fish is all imported. So the fisheries throughout the 80s, 90s, have explained to you, they have expanded out from the overfish area out in the world. Now, we all know that the world is flat. So at some point, you fall off the edge. And that precisely is what is happening now. We are falling off the edge of the fisheries world. Now, what we can do then is eat right. And have my student here who writes such beautiful things as what we should eat and why we should eat this. I'm presenting this slide just as a defense mechanism, because at least in the US, maybe not in Canada, but in the US, people always ask me, what should they eat then, the situation being what it is? And I said, oh, no. Jennifer has an answer. This is not a photo, actually. This is a photo montage. Can you see that he's cheated, actually? Because this thing moves, actually. This is just to say that eating the right fish is something that we should do. Like we should not put our garbage on the street. Like we should switch off light when we get out of a room. But this is not going to resolve our problem. Switching off light that when we get out of the room is not going to solve our problem with global warming. And similarly, eating the right thing is, I've compared it with indulgences. It makes us feel good. It actually might work. But really, the real reason we do it is because we want to have the impression that we do something. And whether we do something or not, is questionable. Anyway, for example, that is detailed in agonizing detail here and in the evolving thinking of this young lady. Anyway, we can conclude some intermediate things. For example, it's not the whales, but we know that. And we need marine protected areas where these nasty things don't happen, because we're messing up everywhere we go. So we need marine protected area. Just like we need Stanley Park to have nice trees. If we allowed people to have chainsaws everywhere they go, we wouldn't have no Stanley Park. We must address overcapacity, and overcapacity, too many boats, has lots of causes. One of them is that the fisheries reserve subsidies. And we must favor small-scale fisheries against large-scale fisheries. And finally, we must make better use of the fish we catch. And because I'm going to say the things we can do, I'm not going to be into gloom and doom. But it's actually difficult. This is the marine protected areas that we are building. A huge growth, right? There are more and more. There are thousands of marine protected areas. And Louisa Wood, one student of mine, and has now submitted to 3 different papers. They don't want it. Anyway, it increased very fast, you think. But the scale, when you look at it, it has lots of zeros. It's only 0.6% of the world ocean. 0.6% of the world ocean. So at present, 99.4% can be fished. 0.6% of the world ocean. When people say, oh, marine protected area, there are too many, they're talking about 0.6% of the world ocean. And at what rate do they grow? Well, if you take logs, whatever that is, and you see this growth here, and you project it. You remember when we projected things, and this was being stupid, 2048 and stuff. Here we project it to to 2080. If we grow these things at 5% per year, marine protected area, where they will be in only, we will not, we'll miss all targets. For example, the Convention on Biological Diversity says we should have 10% of the exclusive economic zone of countries by 2010, and 2,000 of the world, 10% of the world ocean by 2010 also. Well, we will reach that goal in 2060. The World Park Conference, we should have 20% of the world ocean by 2012. Well, we'll have it by 2082 at the present rate of growth. In Canada, the rate of growth is probably less. We have essentially no marine protected area to speak of, and therefore takes 20 years to declare one. So that looks bad. I want to talk about subsidies to fisheries. Now, subsidy to fisheries is the reason why a fishery can continue to operate even though the fish are depleted. Normally, when you go out fishing, you catch the fish because they are abundant, enough to pay for your fuel, to repay the bank, to make your bank payment for the boat, for the loan for the boat, and to have a salary and so on, pay the crew, and the rest is profit and so on, you're happy. But if the fish are depleted, you don't break even. So if things go okay, you will not fish in areas that are depleted. So the fishery would self-stabilize. And I actually learned that when I was going to school. We cannot biologically overfish a stock because we cannot commercially overfish it. When we have commercially overfished it, then the fishery will relax, will go somewhere else. Well, if we subsidize the skipper by buying him a boat, making the fuel cheaper, getting a guaranteed loan that you don't have to really repay, then subsidies, you can actually continue to fish even though the stock is overfished. And the bank, forget about this big black thing here, the World Bank was using a figure of about 20 billion for the subsidies given worldwide to the fishery. And we again put a student to the task, actually two or three, and what we got is 34 billion a year given worldwide to fisheries by governments, and we forget about that figure. And we estimated that this is about 40% of the value of the catch that is landed globally. So subsidies are so enormous that the fisheries throughout the world don't need to respond to the depletion that they cause. And when they continue fishing, they catch even less, and they have to have more subsidies. When the price of fuel goes up, they have to have more subsidies. All the things that should be feedback loops that should cause the fishery to fold because it doesn't work are overcome with subsidies, and that is you and me. Our tax money is paying for that. And there are various kinds of subsidies. Some of them can be seen as good. Yeah, that's what student come up with. The good, the bad, and the ugly. This is Ahmed Khan who did that, indeed. Good subsidies are things like research and management. Bad subsidies is like fuel subsidies and so on. And ugly subsidies depends on the situation. For example, you can pay fishers to retire their boats. That's a good subsidy. But if they know about it in advance, they can go to the bank and say, hey, I'm going to get this money to get a boat. So you can, for my old boat, So I can use this as collateral to get a new boat. And so if they know ahead of a plan to subsidize the retirement of a vessel, it's called decommissioning, it turns ugly because then they use it to build new boats. Now, you think that's crazy, but it happens regularly in Europe. Every time there is decommissioning happening, actually, it's a fleet modernization exercise. That's why in Europe they have such immense problem. We, by region, yes, Asia is the biggest subsidizing continent, and Europe would like to be there, but it's not big enough. North America is doing very well, but it's not because of Canada. It's actually because of the USA. And actually, the USA is not a big subsidizer in fisheries. And therefore, strangely enough, we find the USA representing a positive effect on negotiation at the World Trade Organization. Not agricultural subsidies, that's something else. But subsidies in fisheries, they are playing a positive role. So, enough about subsidies. So, there are basically two kinds of fisheries, right? There are small-scale fisheries. They can be miserable like that. And there are high-tech fisheries. They can be like an airplane or a Starship Enterprise with electronic. And these fisheries compete. They compete sometimes in the same place for the same thing. And this comparison of the two types of fisheries is interesting. Because, and I'm almost finished, because small-scale fisheries employ lots of people. They, in terms of the fish they land that is used for human consumption, they catch almost the same thing. But the jobs that can be created with $1 per dollar are much more. In other words, they require far less money or investments. They produce no fish for reduction, fish meal, and have a much lower fuel consumption. How come our government do not help those? Because those have CEOs that play golf. Those guys don't play golf. They don't get to meet the minister and talk about the subsidies they're going to get or not going to get. I hope there's no minister here. Anyway. In other words, lots of the things we want to do, from conservation to job employment and so on, can be done by small-scale fisheries, by helping small-scale fisheries. And that's as true in developed countries as it is in developing countries. For example, there is one country, one Scandinavian country, I think it's Denmark, which simply does not allow a boat to go without the owner on board, owner-operated boats. And that guarantees that people are involved in the fishery. When a fishery is only a big enterprise, you can get a complete neglect of the environmental setting and of the social setting, and you don't get a social policy to make any sense. Now, I'm almost finished. There are people who believe that aquaculture is the solution to all of this problem. And the growth of aquaculture amylasia, I should have taken recent pictures, but imagine just continued growth. It grows very fast, aquaculture, and it's a solution to the problem. But first of all, most aquaculture, two-thirds of the world aquaculture is in China. This is very strange. Two-thirds of the world aquaculture production is in China. And now I've read in Sofia, in a state of the world fisheries, that they're actually beginning at FAO to doubt that China has this monster aquaculture. The second thing is the fish that are grown by China is mainly mollusks and cyprinids, carps-like animals. That is, they don't have to feed them. Because the salmon, when we talk aquaculture here, we actually mean salmon. In Europe, they would mean salmon and bass and so on, fish that are carnivores that must be fed with fish meal. And when we talk about aquaculture helping produce, helping feed the world, this is true for mollusks and cyprinid. They can be added to the world catch, the world marine catch. But if you're talking salmon, they cannot be added to the world catch because the part of the world catch is needed to produce salmon. And more precisely, a huge amount is needed. This much is needed, is right now used for growing animals, is wasted on pigs, is wasted on chicken, on salmon. And I will explain why I say wasted. I would not have 1 month ago, 2 months ago, but I now think it's wasted. Now, you can say, I say wasted because for pigs and chicken, you can give them other feed. And I say wasted on salmon because salmon, if you eat them for the taste or if you eat them for the omega-3 fatty acid, you would get as much of a taste and far more omega-3 fatty acid if you ate the feed directly. And now I'm not going to show you the feed. That is salmon food. That is what I ate in Peru in an initiative that began by a friend there that the week of Anchoveta, where for the first time people have been convinced to try to eat Anchoveta as opposed to put them in a grinding them up. And she got even the President of the Republic to eat them on TV in his palace. And there is a sea change in the perception. All of a sudden, people realize that they have been wasting this resource because it's wasted when it's fed to a salmon because it can be eaten right there. Now, you Canadian, you think, I'm not going to eat this fish. Well, you are actually eating crab with a K, surimi. You're eating all kind of crap, actually, that is made from scrapes of fish and stuff. We're already eating that stuff. It's far worse than eating this. The Spaniards, the Italian, who know something about fish, they love this fish, and they will buy them. And that, hopefully, will be competition for the fish meal industry. And I hope it will go broke. And if it does, there will be no more salmon. You will have to eat this. But they are good, I'm telling you. Here, look at this, sushis, anchoveta sushis and so on. Very nice. So if you ask me, what can I eat? I say anchoveta. And if they don't have any, import them. Why not? So the conclusion. Gloom is justified. I looked what the definition is for gloom, and we're certainly in a situation where gloom is appropriate because this is really serious. Now, doom is a judgment. The judgment is made, and you are condemned to whatever, burning in hell and stuff. And we never have that because we always, as long as we are alive, as long as there is life in the ocean, there are options. And we should pick up these options and make something, make the best of it. So doom not, but gloom, yes, because this is serious. And this is just a part of the environmental mess that we are causing, and that manifests itself, obviously, in global warming. That's a big problem, and that's also a gloom problem, not a doom problem, really. So what can you do? Well, you can eat the right fish and enjoy them, because some of them are really tasty, but don't think that's all you can do. That's not right. You have to write to your MLA and give them hell. What we need to do is to actually give them hell. And you can actually support an environmental NGO. David Suzuki Foundation, if you want to go local, there is WWF, and so on. These are good people, and they fight on your behalf. So you can give them money, or you can become a member at large and help them out. And that's it. Good night.
You have been listening to Dr. Daniel Pauly of UBC on March 10, 2007, on the topic, Global Fisheries, Are the Gloom and Doom Justified? Our thanks to Dr. Pauly and the Vancouver Institute for allowing this recording, and to audio technician David Gold. You can download the lively question and answer period that followed as a separate file from www.ecoshock.org in the Oceans section.